Clearly, chemistry is a very complicated subject, and education is clearly also a complicated subject. As we heard earlier, there are lots of potentially conflicting theories. So how much scientific research actually gets into education policy? David James is a sociologist and researcher in education at Cardiff University. So, David, basically the big question is there research supporting the way that children are taught?
There is. For a moment there, I thought you were going to ask me a science question and I was getting nervous. Yes, there is. I mean, there's an awful lot of educational research, perhaps not as much as we need. In the 5 years up to 2014, the Research Excellence Framework process that looks at the quality of education research recorded about £290 million worth of research in the education field in that five-year period. That actually sounds like a great deal of money. It's not that much if you compare it to some branches of engineering or even actually psychology and neuroscience. But it's still sizable. And that includes a lot of studies that are done by academics, sometimes academics working directly with teachers and sometimes working directly with policymakers. And some of that research does have direct impact. You know, a good example might be a piece of work by Oak Hill and Kane on the teaching of reading. But there are many, many examples of work that does find its way through into legislation, into the curriculum, and into classrooms as well.
But what about the kind of ways that children are taught now? I mean, is everything that a kid will go through at school, is that based on evidence?
Definitely not. It's understandable that it's not based on evidence. You know, we have a long tradition of schooling. If you think about where schools started, think why we have the subjects we do have at GCSE. It's not because someone's, you know, done a thoroughgoing study and decided that's what we need. It's partly because that's what went into the pre-grammar school curriculum a few hundred years ago. So there's an awful lot of tradition, there's an awful lot of joint professional assumptions, many of which are useful and many of which, you know, have on a daily basis proved their worth.
But then what sort of sciences are now feeding in to educational policy? I mean, you've mentioned psychology, but what sort of scientific research does go into education?
Well, that's a really good question because it's a pretty broad field. Education is an interdisciplinary subject, if you like. It draws on disciplines like philosophy, sociology, economics, psychology, social policy, political science, all sorts of things get into the mix in different studies, and that's seen as a good thing. I think the point I would make about it, though, is that there is a problem with the way in which the big issues in education are conceived very often, and they're seen as sort of amenable to amelioration through work with individuals or with individual learners, when often they're actually system problems. They're
so
much bigger.
These problems are really big that need addressing
really
through research.
Yeah.
And so say there are things that research throws up and says, oh, actually, this would be a really good idea if we started doing X like this. How do you get that information to teachers, to policymakers? I mean, what's the sort of the flow like from the research to the actual people on the ground?
Yeah, it could be a lot better. There was a spell in the 1980s when some in policy circles were blaming educational researchers for not working hard enough to do that. I think that's now seen as both a thing that's been resolved and to have been a bit politically motivated at the time as well. You know, there's these days also a perception that policymakers might take more notice of research than they do. And there's some really good examples of that. I mean, a good example of a system problem would be some recent research on the children starting school. And many parents will know, you know, that if you're born in August, you might be up to a year younger than your classmates when you start school. Now, that difference traces right through to GCSE. There's actually a really significant difference in the net or average achievement at GCSE from those children who are younger in the class compared to the older children. That's really robust research. It's based on millions of cases. it uses very advanced statistical techniques. You know, it's really robust and rigorous.
We've talked about the kind of research from fields like psychiatry and sociology feeding into education and educational policy. What about some of the, I guess you could call them the harder sciences? I'm thinking things like neuroscience, the real studies of the brain. Have they got benefit for how we teach our kids?
Well, they could have, but I think a lot of the excitement isn't really warranted. The best way to explain that is to say, is to give some examples of what the really big questions are that face the education endeavour as a whole at the moment. Things like the persistent educational inequality and the relationship between people's backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds and so on, and the attainments that they end up with. That's a really persistent thing, and it's got many facets to it. If you take that, I can just list a couple of others quickly, how, for example, specific public examinations that you've been talking about earlier in the programme, GCSEs, are not just used to measure attainment on the part of the individual student, but they become this currency for measuring teachers and schools and head teachers and all sorts of other things. In fact, to such a degree that at times it's almost absurd, the reliance on those for comparing schools. Both of those problems are actually not amenable to much neuroscientific approach.
Yeah, you can't put people in a brain scanner and figure out income inequality.
No, indeed. And furthermore, the problem with that is that there is already a tendency to individualise problems like that. For example, you hear politicians talking about raising aspirations amongst disadvantaged young people. That's quite a regular thing that you hear. But actually, the research evidence shows there's no shortage of high aspirations across most disadvantaged young people. It's not about that.
People do want to do well.
Yeah, they do. And on the whole, you know, they really do. It's not about aspirations. It's about the nature of the system in which they're caught. You can bring to bear all sorts of systematic and rigorous research processes to look at those systems and say things about them that might be useful and might lead to positive change. But the wrong place to look would be inside, as it were, inside the individual, or to look at brain function first and foremost, I would argue.
And is there anything that research has thrown up that you know of that would really make a difference that is just not being implemented? Is there sort of one thing it's like, if we could actually do this, this would make a difference?
A really good example of that is this research work on summer-born children. In this day and age of quite sophisticated data usage, it's really quite simple to use age-adjusted test scores instead of treating everyone in the same school year as if they were the same. It's really simple to do that. And what it would do is to, first of all, give those individuals a clearer picture of where they are. It would compare like with like, rather than comparing them with children who are much older or much younger than they are.
Clearly something that does need some work. Thank you, David James from Cardiff University. And thanks to all our other guests, Robert Plowman, Susanna Claro and Stephen Diston. And to round off the show, it's time for our question of the week. And this time, Laura Brooks has been scrubbing up an answer to this clothy conundrum sent in by Kevin.